we'll start here in a second.
Blog Talk Radio.
Okay. Let's see, tonight. Let's see, which.
Hello.
Yeah, Daryl, which, what's the last four of the four you're calling from?
It's the same one I always call from.
Well, I've actually got 6588.
Right.
Well, that's interesting. I don't have any of those numbers listed on my panel here.
624-388-88. I'm sorry, 624-3884.
Okay. I've got a caller from the same area code with the last four of 5441. Who are you?
That might be my wife.
Oh, she's listening, huh?
Oh. Yeah, she's curious.
Oh, good for her. All right, well, listen, I've got to, man, things are crazy here. My computer crashed, and so I wasn't able to get logged in with my blog talk. But I think if I hang up this phone, we'll be okay, and I can go over to my computer and get logged on in a couple of minutes, but I think it'll leave me, all of us, online. If not, if for some reason you get disconnected, call back in. It's just my computer crashing. I'm trying to get things back up here again.
All right.
So, just a minute to make sure this thing works.
Oh, you still there, Daryl?
I'm here.
Okay. Good there. Hold on a second. Let me see if I can get this up over here. About 15 minutes, all of a sudden my computer, prior to the show starting, my computer locked up, and I've been trying to get back up ever since. Maybe I should play some music before. Doesn't look like it's going to roll. Okay, well, you know what? We'll just have to wait this way. One more minute here, and I'll be ready. Timer set, and then we'll be rolling. Welcome to another exciting episode of Constitutionally Correct Podcastles. I am your constitutional evangelist, and as always with me, the host and the most important person on the show tonight, Daryl Castle, who's going to be delivering three of those wonderful podcasts that he has. Welcome to the show tonight, Daryl.
Thank you, Randy. Always a pleasure.
Well, indeed, and thanks for being here. Well, got some pretty dynamic ones, and in fact, I put the one that you did first, actually four podcasts now because we've gone to a later night, but the first one we could take the entire show doing, and I will try not to do that, but your podcast is called To Pray or Not to Pray, so tell us a little bit about that one, Daryl.
Well, this is a case of Town of Greece versus Galloway that the U.S. Supreme Court has agreed to hear in its October term. And it was a case from the town of Greece, New York, which is a small community outside of Rochester, New York. And since 1999, this town has had a policy of having a minister come over, a different denomination each time, but always a Christian minister, a Protestant Christian minister, who would pray before the town meeting. And a couple of people, one of whose name was Galloway, the lead the lead plaintiff, objected to this, and they got the Americans for Separation of Church and State to file a lawsuit on their behalf against the town because the town refused to stop doing it. And this case has gone up the line, and the Second Circuit, the New York Circuit, reversed it and said that it violated the First Amendment's Establishment Clause and that it was an establishment of religion. So the Supreme Court's agreed to hear this. Now, they ruled, the Supreme Court did, in 1983, in the Walsh case, that it was okay for government to do this because it was a tradition. That's what they said. It's just an American tradition. Congress even does it, and it's traditional in America, so it was okay. But for reasons of their own, they've decided to hear this case, and that's kind of where it is.
Well, you know, one of the things that you had mentioned, and I was thinking about this, is you always hear about this establishment clause. But, you know, what really hacks me off about this whole thing is they tend to forget the free exercise clause.
Yeah, but does government have the right to free exercise? That is the question that... The question becomes, if government prefers one religion over another, in other words, the minister is always a Christian, it's obviously a preference for the Christian religion, if government chooses to do that, does that violate the Establishment Clause, or does it not? And my contention is that it doesn't. It is simply the choice of this particular government. The people of that town could change it anytime they wanted to. In many different ways, by voting these people out of office, for one thing, and they don't choose to do that. So it's a choice, in my opinion, and not an intent to establish a religion. It is simply, to me it seems obvious that they're preferring the Christian religion, as Americans have always done throughout its history. As I pointed out in the podcast, the Congress... at the time of the Constitutional Convention, and immediately afterward, hired a Christian minister to act as a chaplain, one in the House and one in the Senate. Now, would they have intended to make illegal something that they had just done? Obviously not. So the question becomes, is that still relevant today, or is it not?
Well, I think there's another important relevance here as well, is when this Constitution was ratified, not only did they have, you know, soon thereafter the chaplaincy there, you know, I mean, it was kind of, you know, I believe, as I recall my history correctly, that Benjamin Franklin was pretty much instrumental in establishing prayer within the Senate and to have a chaplaincy within the Senate. But, you know, be that as it may, there's two points that I think are absolutely vital and crucial to this particular issue. Number one, the Establishment Clause says Congress shall not. Okay? It doesn't say the state or the city shall not. It says Congress. In other words, the federal government cannot do that. Point number one. Number two is that when this Constitution was ratified, there was actually state-sponsored religion. There was actually state religions within, what I want to say, state recognized specific religions within those individual states when this Constitution was written. So there was no infringement upon states having their own state religion if they wanted. So to say that this Constitution limits a particular entity, no matter how large or small, except for, you know, I mean, maybe the conversation could be made as to whether Congress should have one, but when we're talking about Congress cannot, it doesn't say states cannot, it doesn't say cities, counties, or any of these schools cannot. So I think those are two important points to be made here.
Well, to refute both your points, the 14th Amendment, the federal courts have routinely and always used the 14th Amendment to apply the Bill of Rights to the states. If you want to take that one step further, do states have the right to violate the Second Amendment or the Fifth Amendment? Congress and the federal court system has always taken the position that the 14th Amendment is intended to apply the Bill of Rights to the states. And as to the second, yes, what you said there is true about the Founding Fathers, and it's irrefutable that the no establishment of religion was intended to prevent the national government, the federal government, the general government, if you will, from taking the position that one particular Christian denomination had preference over another, since all of the 13 colonies had their own particular colonial religion. You know, Virginia was Baptist, and Pennsylvania was Quaker, and so forth. Maryland was Catholic, and that's what they wanted to prevent. They wanted everybody to be free to practice their own denomination as they saw fit. But the argument that it doesn't apply to the states has been refuted by the courts, whether we agree with it or not. That is established precedent from the Supreme Court on down.
Well, now you use another real interesting word, establishing precedent. You know, the precedent has been set that it's okay to do this. And so now you've got courts that are trying to overcome the precedent that's been set. You know, this whole precedent law just drives me up a wall because it's only precedent at somebody's convenience.
Well, that's only semi-true. Precedent is a very valuable form of law. It establishes order in the law. It lets people know what the law is so that every single case is not a completely new issue before the system and before the courts. Lawyers and people that deal with it every day have some knowledge of what they're of what they're dealing with and of the system. But and it's a way of handing down from one set of rules to another. But the 14th Amendment was intended to prevent the states and from hiding behind that rule that you just said and continuing slavery or continuing to discriminate against freed slaves and that sort of thing. And since the Civil War, it's been applied to the states.
Well, how do you address the remaining part of that clause? Because they always talk about, you know, the establishment clause as if that Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion, and they always stop there.
Yeah,
but it continues on to say, or prohibiting the free exercise thereof.
Yeah, I don't want to be put in the position of defending this ruling because I'm not in favor of it. But the issue is whether to tell the government that they cannot prefer one religion over another is preventing free exercise is a bit of a stretch, it seems to me. I mean, it has nothing to do with the individual. It's the general government, which we all vote, and 50% of us pay taxes and so forth.
Well, but at the same time, how does allowing just one specific particular sect of religion, if we want to call it that, in light of, you know, the many various religions, how is it that, you know, okay, I may be doing a little bit preference. While it may be preferential treatment, I don't know, but the question comes to my mind, you know, I guess a roundabout way you could say that's establishing, but there is absolutely no way in my mind that just, you know, that establishes a religion. It doesn't.
Well,
the religion's already established.
My position is that it does not violate the Establishment Clause for that reason. It is clearly preferring one religion over another. But the answer to that is so what? In my opinion, it does not establish a religion, and the people of that town are free, as I said, at any time they want to change their government and prevent them from doing that.
Exactly. And the fact that it not only does it not infringe on that quote unquote establishment part, but you know what? I'm still stuck on this, you know, the free exercise thereof. Why are they not able to, okay, let's just say they are predominantly Christians. There are probably no specific, other religions that are represented. And so, therefore, they are free to exercise thereof. Why should some other bonehead come in there and infringe their free exercise rights?
Well, any citizen of that town is free to exercise any religion they want as they see fit.
Exactly.
The Second Circuit just said that to do it as a governmental body, to put the force of government behind it, is an establishment. That was their opinion.
I'm not seeing it, brother. I am not seeing it at all. So what do you think the outcome is going to be on this?
It's an interesting question because you have to ask yourself, why would the court take this case if they wanted the decision to pray by a governmental body struck down? All they had to do was let the Second Circuit's decision stand, and that's it. But they didn't. They took this case for some reason. So either they want to make some broad pronouncement that will be law across the board in this type of thing, or else they just want to clarify some points that were made in it that they seem to have a problem with.
And is there any indication as to what those might be?
No, not at all. I mean, they could go back to what they said in Walsh and say, look, we thought we told you. Now, but first of all, when I say we, I mean the court in general, because no member of the current court was sitting at the time of the Walsh decision in 1983. But they could say, you know, the court made it clear that this was simply an American tradition and that there's nothing wrong with it. So we reversed the Second Circuit's decision. They could do that, or they could make it even more, even broader if they wanted to, and there's no indication. I mean, you look at the makeup of the court and so forth, and you would have to think that the majority would vote with a more liberal slant, but you never know that for certain. It is an American tradition. I don't like that provision of it because it reduces faith to nothing more than a tradition, like I always sit in the same seat and that sort of thing.
Right.
But still,
well,
I'm sorry.
That's all the time we got on this segment. I'm tempted to go down it a little bit more because of some of the things that move on with the case that happened with Chief Justice Roy Moore and that sort of stuff. But I guess we'll let this lying dog lay for the moment, and we'll move on. So, folks, stay with us, and we'll be back in just a moment with another podcast. Welcome back to our second segment of Constitutionally Correct Podcastles. And we just hit that kind of a, I think is one of the, I don't know, I think it's going to be a very important thing that we're going to be taking a look at in regarding to this whole issue of prayer and how it's going to stand. But be that as it may, the next podcast is one that Daryl created regarding the title of it is Immigration Plus Unemployment Equals Riots, and he talks about what's going on there in Sweden. So, Daryl, tell us a little bit more about this one.
Well, people have been rioting now in Sweden for about 2 weeks now, every night, burning cars, burning businesses and things like that, and it's, for the most part, this seems to be immigrant, as they refer to them, as I said, in the immigration world, as youth. But Sweden has a serious problem. Sweden has always been a country that's been looked at as a beacon of peace and tranquility because it has the most generous welfare state in the world. And Sweden has 9.5 million people living there, and now about 15% of them are immigrants, mostly Middle Eastern and African people, and these people have a terrible unemployment rate among people 25 and under, it's 35.5%. And that is a recipe for disaster, and their welfare state doesn't cover it. As I said, the point of it is not just to look at Sweden, but to apply Sweden across the European Union, which is coming. Other countries are suffering from it now. I just saw today where France and Germany are taking steps to pacify their unemployed youth by giving them money and so forth. To try to prevent this sort of thing, but it is something that has a tendency to spread. When you have young people that are full of energy and have no real tie to your country, they say quite openly that we don't want to integrate into Swedish society. You know, we want to bring our society to Sweden, and they're unemployed and shiftless.
What kind of immigrants are we talking about? Are we talking like we have here in the United States, the Mexicans, or are they being bombarded by their border countries?
No, there's no concept of illegality in this. These people come there for the most part legally because Sweden has open borders and has had since World War II. These immigrants are primarily people from the Middle East. About 50% of them are people from Afghanistan, Syria, and Iraq. And, you know, what does that tell you? This immigration is driven by war. War displaces people. We have a war going on in Mexico right now, the drug wars, where 48,000 people have been killed there in the last 3 or 4 years from these drug wars. That's all a displacement. The Swedish economy is in better shape than any other country in the economic union, except possibly Germany. But it's not that. They cannot solve their unemployment problems with all these immigrants there who don't want to integrate into their society, and they're just that's what's happening. It's why I said immigration plus unemployment is a recipe for disaster, and out of that recipe comes revolutionary armies and so forth, as we've seen so many different times in history.
Yeah, and you know, mentioning history, you know, the old saying comes to mind so very strongly. You know, he who doesn't understand history is prone to repeat it, and certainly some of this has some portents to the United States, doesn't it?
It certainly does. It refutes some of the arguments that the pro-open borders people make, in that it doesn't hurt our employment. It actually makes it better because, as President Bush said, the illegals do the work that Americans refuse to do. We know that is obviously untrue, but more than that, it drives down the wage base for people that are willing to take low wages for our immigrant population, many of them below the minimum wage paid under the table. And that sort of thing. And as I said, it's a recipe for disaster, and that's what Sweden is experiencing right now. And the EU is very nervous about it and starting to take steps to try to prevent it from spreading, which it's asked to. I mean, it's invariably it will spread as the economic crisis in the European Union gets worse and worse. They can't solve their unemployment problems, and printing money and giving it to them is not the answer. There's something about employment that transcends money. I mean, it gets you off the streets, it gets you out of the bars, and it gives you self-worth as a human being. You know, it's more than just the government giving you money to feed your family. You're actually earning it yourself.
Well, and therefore, it has more importance, it has more relevance. You don't give it away so freely if you don't get it so freely. But you said that they're taking steps. Any idea what these kind of steps are?
Well,
that
sure.
They're taking?
As I said, they're trying to bolster the businesses that might employ young people, and they're starting to give them permission to hire young people, especially immigrants, at lower wage than the prevailing European Union wage laws permit. And they're starting to aid them through their welfare system to just increase the amount of I suppose we could call it welfare and their social safety net or whatever you want to call it, going to these people.
Yeah, it is extremely bizarre to me, you know, because of the fact that, you know, what we're seeing is they're trying to do it, and they're demonstrating such a dismal failure at it. And for the folks here in the United States, and I say folks, I'm talking about the national leadership that tries to paint this picture of, you know, well, let's give them all these benefits and how this helps the United States. But, you know, the fact of the matter is the more money they give out to these people and I think, correct me if I'm wrong, you mentioned printing money. Is it the fact that they're just printing money and giving it to them and making the rest of the money be worth less, or are they, you know, giving up more of the taxpayers' money, and so now the taxpayers have to work harder to pay the money for these people who are not working and those people who are not so willing to do the jobs that we aren't so willing to do, so to speak?
Well, the term printing is probably a misnomer. The central banks create this money on their computer systems, and it's all backed by the central bank, the Federal Reserve, but there's no taxpayer money to give them. These countries are head over heels in debt, just like we are. They're struggling to make ends meet, and this money is just created out of thin air, but it does have to be repaid. I mean, it goes on the books as debt, and it eventually is expected to be repaid by taxpayers, yes. It's either have taxpayers repay it or you default eventually. There's no other choice.
You know, I almost hate to go down this road, but, you know, I grew up in an era where, especially within the Christian religion specifically, I mean, I grew up in a time when Christians were absolutely unequivocally out of their mind, head over heels, in fear of a one-world government. And this just, I mean, you know, when we're seeing that these, you know, the central bank and the monetary force, I can't even think of it, monetary fund.
International monetary fund.
Yeah, that one. And when you see all these controls and the things that they're doing, you know, I almost go back to my old saying, just because I'm paranoid doesn't mean they're not out to get me. Is it these central banks that are destroying the economy of these countries? Are they country killers? And so that they can one day just say, hey, we are the answer to everything and usurp the governments across the globe?
Well, the answer to your question is yes. But the International Monetary Fund, I mean, as you know, the Federal Reserve came into being in 1913, but it really didn't reach full power until the end of World War II. And at the end of World War II, the leaders of the world, and these weren't people who, only a few of them were elected by the people. These were people that were appointed. They sat down and they created a new country, a new America, and a new world. And that country, its finances was based on the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, the United Nations, and it was decided that the United States would have the world's reserve currency. That's being challenged now by certain countries like China and Russia and so forth. But the answer is yes, central banks do run the world. They run the world's economies, and the economies control everything. I mean, that's what there is. When people control your money supply, they control you, as we're so fond of saying. But that is the way it is inevitably headed unless something is done. As the old saying goes, because something's inevitable doesn't mean it's imminent. You know, who knows what the timetable is? These folks are pretty good at taking a couple of steps back and punting, but that seems to be the way it's headed. They have created so many problems in the world that they seem to be unsolvable, and they are not solvable without some pain. And no one wants to be the one who inflicts the pain on the voting public. But sooner or later that pain is going to come, and as they say, sooner or later, later becomes sooner, and we will have to deal with it in either a planned fashion or in a catastrophic collapse. That's my opinion.
Wow. And what's so bizarre about it is where all that's taken place. I mean, you know, I'm still, in my mind, somewhat reeling over Cyprus. I'm somewhat reeling over some of these other economic collapses. I mean, how do we get out of this? I mean, how does the United States survive in this kind of a calamity?
Well, the United States is to survive economically is going to have to go through the valley. Like I said, it's going to have to, you know, there just aren't many pleasant ways to deal with $17 trillion of own budget debt and perhaps $100 trillion or more of off-budget obligations. There is no possible way out of that except eventually default. And, I mean, that could be decades or generations for all I know, but it is inevitable that it's going to happen unless something drastically changes. I mean, when you have no growth, the only growth in GDP is government spending. They talk about, we had 1.2% GDP growth last quarter, which is abysmal, and then they'll say, oh, it was 2%. That's a little better. It's all government spending. I mean, government spending is included in GDP. I mean, it's all just ridiculous. Every administration wants to just push the manure pile a little bit further down the road until they're out of office and somebody else can deal with it. And nobody has the courage to vote for anybody who says, no, let's deal with it now.
Well, that's certainly why we need Constitution Party candidates, then, isn't it, Daryl?
That is a very good reason, yes. But when you tell people the truth, you know, my election, I would deal with these problems, but we're not going to escape them without some pain. There's going to be consequences. Who wants to hear that when he's got somebody else saying, oh, yeah, I'm the answer. I'll make things right for you. You'll have a job. You'll have a new car. You'll have a new home. And there'll be free money for everybody. Which would you rather have? I mean, that sounds pretty good to most people.
Yeah, I guess it does. It sounds like a recipe for disaster to me. And but you know what was the saying? As soon as people realize that they can start voting themselves benefits, you know, it's almost all over. But the crying, I guess. But well, that's it for our second segment, folks. Stay with us, and we'll be right back for that third and final segment for the recording part of our broadcast. So join us here in just a few minutes. All righty, welcome back to our third and final segment of Constitution Part or Constitutionally Correct Podcastles. And our third segment is going around Operation Vigilant Eagle. So give us a shot there, Daryl.
Well, Operation Vigilant Eagle is a policy started under Homeland Security, under the auspices of the FBI, where they would look at very carefully incoming veterans coming home from Iraq and now Afghanistan and other areas of combat around the world. And they would examine these people for the possibility that they might be, quote, lone wolf terrorists. By lone wolf terrorists, they mean someone who doesn't associate with any other extremists and are not members of extremist groups, so they can be identified that way. And they have decided for one reason or another that veterans have the propensity to be some of these people. So they've started to examine them and look at their finances and so forth. And they were perusing the Facebook account of this gentleman named Brandon Robb. This happened last summer. And he had posted some comments on Facebook that one could say were anti-government, and he favored state and local government over the national government and that sort of thing. And they sent a team of people, including officers from the state of Virginia and Homeland Security, to his house, and they took him outside wearing just a pair of shorts, no shoes, and they questioned him for about 15 minutes. And then they arrested him, and they took him into custody, and they started a process that lasted about a week of transferring him from one mental health system to another. And finally, the Rutherford Institute, John Whitehead, who runs it, got involved in his case, and they got him a hearing before the circuit court in Virginia, and the circuit judge ordered him released, saying there was no evidence whatsoever in the government's charges against him, and ordered him released. And now, almost a year later, the Rutherford Institute has filed a civil lawsuit against all these people individually, and of course, that's the reason for that, is I assume, to avoid governmental tort immunity and that sort of thing. But they sued them individually in their own rights and in their capacity as government officials, and claiming constitutional violations and false imprisonment and that type of thing. And Mr. Whitehead said that since this case had been going on, there were many, many other veterans coming forward saying they were victims of the same type of thing. So it is kind of ironic that the government calls this a vigilant eagle. They're vigilant and watching their eagles when they come home from the wars that they send them to and train them to fight and so forth. You know, what a government.
And how do I not get myself almost into an exploding rage here when it's this comes, you know, the understanding of this comes right on the heels of, you know, the of Benghazi, where we find that our government leaves our veterans, our loved ones, there behind to be slaughtered and to be killed, with not so much as raising an eyebrow about it. And so here we're to believe that our federal government is out to protect us, right?
Well, that's exactly right. They are out there serving and protecting, as the president said in his speech the other day before the National Defense University that he gave last Thursday. He said that that's exactly what he said, that they're trying to protect us and to promote peace. If the Constitution has no meaning anymore, then the government is irrelevant. Why should we obey it if they don't obey the founding document under which they operate? And I mean, this man, he doesn't even violate provisions of the Patriot Act. He's just an American citizen going about his life, posting things on Facebook that, unfortunately, you can't say anymore, especially if you're a veteran.
Oh, man. Well, you know what? I'm just looking for the day they come to my door. How much fun that's going to be.
The problem is that you and I are both veterans, but we're veterans of different conflicts, and we're too old. These guys that they're looking at are just home from the war. It's still fresh in their blood, and they're young and energetic and full of hope and expectation and so forth, and that's who they want to watch.
Yeah, but, you know, Let's go back just a little bit. I skipped one, and we may hit it back on this on next week. But doesn't the podcast you did on the president on integrity, doesn't that kind of have something to kind of say about all this?
Well, it absolutely does. I mean, that speech was given to the graduating class of Annapolis, the U.S. Naval Academy, last Friday at their graduation ceremonies, and he had the cheek, the audacity, to stand up there in front of these young people and lecture them on morality and integrity and tell them that that's what's lacking, and that they're going to have he didn't use these words, but to get with the program to stop sexually assaulting each other and things like that. And obviously they should do that. But at the same time, he gets rousing applause by saying 13 of these young women, there are 206 women in that class, 13 of them are going to be serving on submarines. These are young women, recent college graduates, going into the submarine force to serve as officers on ships with perhaps all other men, 1,500 feet below the surface of the ocean and so forth. Talk about a recipe for disaster.
Oh, my gosh. Just the sheer stupidity of our government sometimes just blows me away. I mean, it's kind of reminiscent to me, when Republicans call people who don't necessarily belly up to their particular perspective of what a Republican is, they call them a rhino. But yet we have a system where if me and you were to go back to the Republican Party, me and you would be rhinos. We would be Republicans in name only. We don't believe in their platform. We don't believe in most of their positions anymore because they've just totally lost perspective of what it means to be a constitutionalist and American in these United States of America. And so, here's a system that creates its own problem. They want to be this great big tent where they have all of these people, but yet if you don't belly up to a certain mindset, well, then you're a rhino. But yet, what other place are they to go? And so
you mentioned something when you started. You said the stupidity of the government. Well, it's either stupidity or there's something diabolical about it. And I'm not sure that all these Ivy Leaguers are that stupid. Perhaps there is some type of plan behind it all with doing what they're trying to do. But it is definitely having its effect on the military, and it's having its effect on America in general.
Well, Daryl, you were in the Marine Corps quite a few years before I did. Well, maybe not quite a few, but just a couple maybe. But in 1987, when I was actually, I just switched from being a grunt into the computer field, and it was at that point in time that they were going to now integrate women in the barracks. Now, before that, if there was women, they were on the first floor, or they were in a building all to themselves, and there was a duty, and never did a male Marine go in there without a public announcement. Doors were open. There was always an element of protecting the women from any promiscuity from the men whatsoever. And then, I'm telling you, Daryl, when I was in school in Quantico, Virginia, studying for my new MOS in the computer field, they sent us to the barracks. They said, there is a directive that we must now integrate the women throughout the barracks. There's no more just having them on the first floor. There is a distribution, and so it wasn't even grandfathered in. So if you get a female in, you just put her in the next open room. No, you had to go to the barracks, and they were reassigning you rooms so that they could move these women throughout the barracks. And I'm telling you, Daryl, there will be people pissed off at me when I say this, but the barracks became a whorehouse overnight.
Yeah, it's something that whorehouses or something. You probably are more experienced at than I am, but when I served, I served in Quantico too. I was there for 6 months at the what we call the basic school at Camp Barrett, the basic officers course, and there were no women whatsoever. I mean, the first woman I ever saw there was at the PX one day, and I was walking out, and I saw a woman Marine in uniform, and the friends I had with me, we talked about it, and these people served in administrative clerical type work far away from where any men were. That's the way it was then, but this is the way it is now.
What number you will never see? I mean, I've, because of this integration of women in the various areas, the numbers that you will never see posted out there is how many women have had abortions because of the sexual promiscuity, and how many married women who have had babies who weren't their husband's babies because of the situations that they have been in. And so, they create this freaking system that is doomed from failure from the outset just to create these failures. And I just, like you said, is it diabolical or is it just plain stupidity? And I, I'm kind of with you. I think there's a shred of intelligence, so there has to be some diabolical position of putting our women in danger.
If I were, if I wanted to take the other side of the argument you just made, I would say that, you know, there's something wrong with the male members of the military, and those attitudes have to be changed, and they're not going to be changed as long as we segregate people. We have to integrate them, and I would go back and talk about how at one point the military was segregated racially. Any black people in the military were relegated to menial jobs, and it was integrating them into the mainstream forces that brought about change in attitude and so forth. As we all worked together and fought together and died together and so forth, we come to realize that we're all just people. That would be
right.
The argument to refute that. But there is something slightly different about this. And, you know, when you mix a lot of young males who, in my day, as I've said many times, when we were in foreign countries, the governments of these two countries, the occupying government, which was us, and the host government, which was whoever we occupied and whatever puppet government we set up, cooperated in turning the women of that country into prostitutes. And that relieved the stresses and the tensions of all these young men who were over there in a very dangerous environment. And this attitude that you have when you're in that type of environment, that nothing matters, life itself is very cheap, and so forth. These are things that happen, and you know, we know right now
right.
that 35.
Well, Darryl, let me cut you off there because we got just a few seconds left, and I do want to say that, you know, I am not, neither are you. Neither of us are making excuses for men to do the wrong thing. We're not saying that. We're just saying that our government is, you know, putting our men and women into positions that's really unnecessary and not required. And of course, you know, we've got these men and women that are going across the ocean fighting battles where they shouldn't be, and then putting them in these positions and then wanting to have the vigilant eagle eye upon them because we think they're going to be rogue or whatever. And I mean, they put them in this position. So, you know, we've got some major problems, and we need to get constitutionalists elected that will start upholding not only the Constitution, but the moral values that this country was based upon. Well, that's all the time we got, folks, for tonight. Join us again next Wednesday, and our show has gone from Tuesday to Wednesdays, if you haven't noticed. And we will be doing Constitutionally Correct podcasts from now on Wednesday evenings at 8 p.m. Central. So join us again next week for some more exciting episode of Constitutionally Correct Podcastle. Well, thank you very much, Darryl. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure, and as always.
Sorry about the mix-up from last night on that.
That's no problem. No problem at all. I just went straight down to the pool after I didn't get you.
I wish I could have been, but I was actually, tomorrow night is going to be Constitution Party Talk Radio, and I'll be interviewing Doug Inyart again, who's running for Congress, and he was in debate with the Democrat, Republican, and there was a Libertarian candidate, and they had all four of those candidates on stage, and it was a televised debate for Southeastern Missouri, so that was pretty cool.
Yeah, good for him. Well, it was a good discussion tonight. Those were good topics to talk about.
and I don't mind being devil's advocate or us both on those roles because it certainly creates the dialogue.
Yeah, that's what we need to do. I try to give the opponent's view. I mean, the government, you know that's what they're going to say, so you might as well come out with it and figure some way to try to refute that, but the government is virtually always wrong in almost everything. And they
hey,
lie.
Here's a podcast for you.
Yeah, they lie about everything.
Common Core.
Yeah.
Yeah. That. Well, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. Keep go ahead, and then I'll bring up the topic.
No, I'm done.
Common Core.
Yeah.
Common Core is getting to be a pretty big issue and topic right now.
It is.
Yes, it is. We've got they're starting to implement it in several schools, and the debate is it you know, a good basis foundation to build on, or is it actually very destructive? And there's several people that are going around talking about it, and that it is a very destructive form of education. And being,
well,
you know, it's.
I'm opposed to government education in the first place, but
yep.
I'm doubly opposed to whatever that is. I'll do some research on it. Maybe I can talk about it sometime.
Yeah, yeah, that'll be a good one. So, all right, brother. Well, I think we, in fact, we did, if my stopwatch was of any value, we did really good on time, and it'll be fairly easy to edit this tonight. So thought that was real good and good quality. And what did your wife think as listening to the thing?
No, I got to go inside and ask her. She's inside working on her computer, and I'm out in the garage having a cigar and a couple of beers.
All righty, brother. All right, well, God bless you, and we'll catch you a little bit later.
All right, my friend. Thanks again.
All right, thank you, and good night.
At the end,
yeah.
Tried to push, I mean, I pushed one, but he didn't.
You weren't muted the whole time. I could hear everything you were saying.
What?
If you could get it, did you hear it?
Yeah.
What do you think? You're saying it's shut up.
Oh, my God.
So you were in the background. I thought
it was good.
It was good.
Yeah, you did.